I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today is with voters in Pennsylvania, where many Democrats still haven't made up their minds. But first, how safe are American airliners and passengers if, as two whistleblowers claim, the Federal Aviation Administration is too cozy with the airline industry? This morning, two federal safety inspectors gave damning testimony to members of Congress. Inspector Bobby Boutrous said that managers at the FAA and Southwest Airlines knowingly bypassed him, kept him in the dark, after he found Southwest continued to fly airplanes that had missed inspections and were unsafe.
FAA inspectors are hired by the taxpayers to ensure airlines conduct their business with safety as the utmost consideration at all times. Allowing an airline to fly passengers on an aircraft with a known unsafe condition puts the lives of the flying public at jeopardy. And in my opinion, it is dereliction of duty and should be criminal.
Yesterday, United Airlines became the fourth major airline to ground planes in the past month due to safety concerns, and the FAA announced investigations of four unnamed airlines for failing to comply with federal regulations. Well, joining us, reporter Alexandra Marks, covering this story for the Christian Science Monitor. Alexandra, House Transportation Committee Chair James Oberstar blasted the FAA today. He says it needs to clean house from top to bottom. What did he mean?
Well, he said this is the most egregious lapse in safety that he's seen in the past 23 years. And what he basically means is that there's the rigorous environment of safety enforcement, which was, you know, designed as a result back in like 1996 when they overhauled the FAA last time, seems to have become very lax, and that the FAA inspectors who are charged with being sure that the airlines make safety a priority have gotten a little too cozy, and cozy being, you know, Southwest says, oh, yes, you know, gosh, we did miss that airworthiness directive inspection, but, you know, we'll do it next week, but we'll just keep flying, and nobody needs to know, whereas by law, they should have been grounded.
Well, you write that when the system changed, as you said, in 1996, after the Value Jet crash in the Florida Everglades, it went from, and see if I've got this right, something like you fix something, when something needs to be fixed, all airplanes are inspected for that, and then you fly, to if there's a problem, trust us to repair and report it, we'll keep track, and then we'll fly.
Well, it's a little more complicated than
that. Yeah.
Initially, it was, you know, fix and fly, where if there was a crash, the NTSB would do an investigation, they'd find out what the cause of the crash was, and then they would put out an airworthiness directive, and they would be sure that, you know, every airline indeed, you know, followed certain procedures or made a fix on their airplanes to prevent further crashes. What they thought would a better way is to encourage airlines themselves to report problems so that they could have, they call it a risk-based analysis, so that they could take a look at, you know, say 10 pilots report that there's a little problem with a landing gear on a particular Boeing plane. Now, in the old system, that pilot would keep it to themselves, and or they might report it to their airline, but it would get fixed. But it wouldn't get to the FAA necessarily.
Right.
So this new system allowed the FAA to, what they said is, we won't penalize you if you report these problems so that we can figure out and predict what might be a problem and prevent it. So the whole idea is to prevent crashes by doing this risk-based analysis. But in order to do that, you need to have a cooperative relationship. And there's always been a question about how do you balance that cooperation that which is needed with the regulation which is needed to ensure. And what Oberstar and other critics are saying is, you know, that balance is now way out of whack.
Well,
the pendulum has swung too far.
In the meantime, the ranking Republican pointed out that there hasn't been an airline fatality on a large plane since 2001. The FAA chief said yesterday, flying safer today than any time in the past. Very briefly, Alexandra, where does it go from here?
Well, I think, yes, the whole idea of this is to ensure that it remains the safest system. What these whistleblowers are saying is, yes, we've got a grand system, but, you know, it is beginning to show cracks itself. And so, and it is good that these changes these problems are being brought to light before airplanes are flying out of the sky. But I do think that there will be major changes at the FAA. There's going to be, you know, we have now only an acting administrator. There's going to be a new administrator. And there's going to be a refocusing on the original mission. Well, not the original mission, but the mission sort of restated in 1996, which is safety first.
Well, we will follow that when that happens. Alexander Marks from the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
This past weekend, the Ridge Restaurant on Route 23 in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, was packed as usual. A perfect place to begin our audio snapshot of the state just weeks before the Democratic primary. There are full families, retirees over there, a group of women holding a PTA meeting, and everywhere, large groups of men clustered around pushed together tables.
What is the name of your group?
We're called the Moron Club, and that's what the wives call us because they think because we meet together here and exclude the wives that we're morons. There's a group before us, I know, and I think when we leave, there's another group coming.
Okay, well, what do you discuss at your moron meeting?
They told me this morning when I tried to start a political discussion here that politics are off the table. So we talked about trout fishing and a couple flocks of turkey in the area, things like that.
Well, why? What would the...
We talked about Morning Joe. I don't know if you watch MSNBC, but apparently last Friday there was a little argument between the two main commentators there. We talked about two brother-in-laws. One ended up being stabbed down in Collegeville over politics, so we're trying to stay away from it. It gets to be a little too violent.
Oh. Is it more heated this year, do you think, than other years?
We've been talking about that. We said it is really interesting, that we think that it's probably more heated than other years, that it's only going to warm up as the summer goes along. So, yep, that's what we're anticipating.
By the way, that story he told is true. Two brothers-in-law, a registered Republican supporting Clinton and a Democrat supporting Obama, got into a brawl. One's now in the hospital, one's in prison. It's unlikely there will be that much disagreement here in the conservative Republican stronghold of Chester County. At the counter, farmers in their tractor caps huddle over home fries.
I understand I'm interrupting farm talk.
Yes, sure. We just do the routine talk that we do every week.
Prices, that this bubble's going to bust.
The bubble they're referring to is the high price of food driven by the skyrocketing price of corn as it's used to make ethanol. These farmers think it's about time Americans paid more for their milk and eggs. They worry that the cost of food and grain will drop back down, but their costs that depend on oil, gas for their tractors, fertilizer, will stay high.
That's what's going to leave us hang.
Do you see any candidate talking about your concerns on either side of the aisle?
No. There's not that many farmers around. The candidates are only worried about what's in Philadelphia and what's in Pittsburgh. Anything in between, they could care less.
Well, I feel as though until those candidates come down to our level, they'll never know what we're faced against.
Well, former President Bill Clinton was here a couple nights ago. That's not what you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about our level of income.
Every time I come here, I see another farm gone and another development up, built up.
Well, you can't blame them for that. They'll never end up having that kind of money in their lifetime.
I mean, the farm is the only retirement a farmer has. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out if you're 65, 70 years old and somebody comes in and offers you X amount for your ground and you're going to lose money farming, what are you going to do?
Across the crowded dining room, I see a lone African-American stirring his coffee.
Are you participating in the Democratic primary?
Yes.
Finally. Have you got your mind made up?
Not exactly.
What do you need to hear from the candidates that you haven't heard yet?
Well, it's not so much what I need to hear, it's what actually I believe they're going to do. You know, it's like bring the soldiers home from the war, you know, help the economy here in this country. We have children in school that don't have books and computers, buildings are falling down, lead paint in the schools, things of that nature. This economy is doing bad, people got homes, they can't afford to pay their mortgage or their rent. You know, we need jobs in this country, this is what we need.
Meanwhile, the debate in the last few weeks has been about Barack Obama's minister and Hillary Clinton's time in Bosnia, whether or not she was under fire.
Well, I'm not going to play into that game about who said what and who was where. You know, I'm not about that. I'm just worrying about what's it going to do in this country as far as taking care of our little children and our grandchildren, you know. Those are the things I'm concerned about.
A few miles away in Kimberton, Pennsylvania, and late one night, a warm yellow light from a picture window pours across a dark horse pasture inside a beehive of activity.
Please vote for him if you...
Devorah Freed is hosting a Barack Obama phone bank evening. Several volunteers from 20 to 70-something calling registered Democrats, filling out forms from the Obama campaign.
Message left message.
Is this tough? What's the reception you're getting?
It's really interesting. Either I've gotten messages or undecided voters.
Is there one thing that's holding them back from voting for Barack Obama?
A lot of people have brought up the subject of Reverend Wright. For them, it's an issue that maybe they were leaning towards Obama, and it made them not quite sure. They don't understand why he remained with the church. As a person with a unique perspective, I have mixed-race children. I understand those statements very well.
And we should say, for radio listeners, you're white.
Yes. And so I very much understand those comments, but for other people trying to help them find a way to understand them.
Oh, my God. Let me tell you. Oh, my God.
Obama supporters are finding is Democrats want to talk. Lauren, a 26-year-old volunteer, reaches a Clinton supporter who likes Hillary's plan for mandated health insurance. Obama's would only mandate insurance for children, but aim to lower costs for everyone. Lauren goes to work, a job made harder by the fact that Bill Clinton was just in town.
Oh, yeah. He was over at the... Yeah, no. I know. It really is a tough decision this year. Was there a particular reason why you preferred the mandate over, lowering costs?
We leave the Obama campaign workers deep in conversation.
I mean, for me personally, my dad's a truck driver, so occasionally.
Our pygmy elephants are an umbrella species.
The next morning, we head to the Philadelphia Zoo, crowded with families. This young mother wrangles two toddlers, one in a stroller.
I'm pretty sure I'm going to vote for Hillary. I don't know. I just have the feeling that I think she's going to be a better candidate. I think that she's done really well as a senator of New York, and I think that she could do well for our country.
Did any of the recent stories about, her misremembering what happened in Bosnia, whether or not she was under fire, did that dissuade you at all?
I don't think I know anything about that. I don't think I heard much about that.
Oh, really?
This is the first time I've really gotten into an election. So, I'll be happy with either candidate, but I prefer to have Hillary up there.
Hi, is this Dad?
Yeah.
And are you of the same persuasion as your wife?
I haven't really made up my mind yet.
Well, it's right around the corner. Yeah. What do you need to...
I'm leaning towards Hillary because I think she has more experience.
And we are a radio audience, so I can't help but note you have a gorgeous interracial family. So one can't presume that would lead you to vote for Barack Obama just because of that.
No. I like him, but I don't know if he has the experience. I'd like to see whoever doesn't get it become the vice president.
Do you think that's possible after how heated the campaign's gotten?
I don't think so.
That's our audio post from Pennsylvania. And by the way, a new poll shows Barack Obama narrowing the gap with Clinton ahead of the April 22nd primary. But next up, will the primaries be the deciding factor? Later, Scorsese and the Stones, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and as we just heard, many Democratic voters in Pennsylvania ahead of the state's primary are still making up their minds. So let's look at the math. Going into Pennsylvania, Barack Obama leads Hillary Clinton by 134 electoral votes, according to the Associated Press count, and Obama leads in the popular vote as well by 700,000 votes. So even if Hillary Clinton wins Pennsylvania by, say, a 20% margin April 22nd, she could still trail Obama by several hundred thousand votes. Why does she stay in the race? Well, of course, she and her backers believe in her candidacy, but our next guest says history shows the power of the popular vote is less than absolute. Andrew Gumbel is the Los Angeles correspondent for the Independent Newspaper of London. He's written about this history in a recent column in the LA Times. He's also co-author of the book Steal This Vote, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America, which sounds like payback from a Brit. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And we just heard a little bit of everything from Pennsylvania, disenfranchised Republicans, Obama and Clinton supporters, undecided. You say the power of the popular vote isn't as absolute, but that even in modern times, the playing field has been tilted toward establishment candidates. What do you mean?
Well, this is true of the Democratic Party in their primary process, that there's been a tortured history since 1968, which was the last really close presidential primary season when, of course, you had Bobby Kennedy, who surged from nowhere and then was sadly assassinated. You had Hubert Humphrey, who was the vice president. You had Lyndon Johnson, the sitting president, who decided not to rerun. And then after that, when Hubert Humphrey got the nomination but without participating in a single popular primary, I think his official vote count was something like 2% of the vote over the whole primary season. Mm. The Democratic Party's gone through a series of changes. In the 70s, they just let it be open season, open voting. And then starting in the 80s, they started to build the system that we have now with a number of guarantees that I do believe, and a lot of Democrats believe, are explicitly designed to favor the establishment candidate. One of those measures is front-loading the calendar so that only those candidates with a lot of money right at the beginning can really compete effectively. And most years, those candidates will knock everybody else out very quickly, certainly by Super Tuesday. The other is, of course, the superdelegates, which have been much discussed this year. And mm-hmm. the superdelegates, by definition, are really the party establishment who are called upon, if need be, to subvert the will of the people and impose their own idea.
Well,
they're completely free to do that.
That's one way of putting it.
Or alternatively, to endorse what the people have decided. Mm-hmm. But they're the ones with the power, not the voters.
Well, the subvert word, I just have to rush in to say, Clinton backers would say that superdelegates were invented to make sure an electable candidate was put forth and party officials had some say. Obama supporters, at least this year, this is how the split has been, are saying, no, superdelegates are obliged to follow the popular vote. And that's been the debate all year.
Right. Well, they're not obliged to follow anything.
Right.
When I use the word subvert, what I mean is that, you know, in the end, the will of the people is not paramount. And if the party feels that the people have chosen the wrong candidate, there's a mechanism there for correcting them. It's never happened. And I think the overwhelming likelihood is it won't happen this year either. But the possibility exists.
Look ahead. What do you think is going to happen? I watched Tim Russert this morning get out all of his charts and his pens and say that he thinks it could be a dead tie.
Well, I mean, you know, anything is possible, obviously. And but, you know, I think given the lead that Obama has in the popular vote and in the pledged delegates, which is unlikely to be eroded, it's not impossible, but it's unlikely. There is a question mark about Michigan and Florida, whose primaries were not recognized by the National Party because they broke the rules about the day they held their contest and because, frankly, the candidates didn't really properly compete. But, you know, in all that confused mathematics, the most likely outcome, and it's been felt to be this way really ever since the last major primaries in Ohio and Texas at the beginning of March, is that Obama will end up ahead. Now, given that situation, there are two questions. What do they do about that, given he'll be ahead, but he won't have the magic number of delegates needed to clinch the nomination? And question number two, what does the rest of primary season really mean? And I think there's a very good argument from the point of view of the party for saying, well, what it means is spreading the enthusiasm, getting people to register in record numbers, and setting the party up to be in very good shape for November. The counter-argument to that is the danger that people will feel like, well, the contest is really over. We know it's close. We know Obama's going to be ahead. Why are they coming to us, and why are the candidates beating up on each other and making each other seem that much more unattractive? And all of these things have been in play for the last few weeks. Just this week, it sounds like, and we'll see whether this keeps up, both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have decided to set their sights not on each other but on John McCain. That's a new development. And, you know, one of the complaints a few weeks ago was, well, it's fine them carrying on their fight, but please can they do it in a classy way, not drag each other down? That message seems to have got through, at least to some extent.
Well, in fact, Hillary Clinton has re-released her It's 3 a.m. ad, but substituting for some sort of war or attack the economic crisis and saying John McCain wouldn't be able to take action in the housing crisis. And Barack Obama also holding his fire against Clinton, saying last night on MSNBC, she can stay in the, you know, she should stay in the race. You know, he just wants to win as many contests as possible. They seem to be focusing on McCain. And, you know, Hillary Clinton, we hear this on the ground, that Hillary Clinton is winning admirers for the fact that she is, you know, a fighter and staying in, as well as detractors who are saying that she's become an impediment.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I think that what all of this adds up to is that, you know, this race is much more about the quality of the political campaign that each candidate manages to lead rather than an exercise in mathematics of what the voters say they want. And, you know, the process is certainly flawed, even in terms of adding up calculating the will of the people. You have some states that have caucuses, which by definition are a very restricted electorate. I'm not a big fan of caucuses. And in the current circumstances, it doesn't sound like Hillary Clinton is either, but that's because she hasn't been winning them. You can bet that if she'd been winning the caucus, she'd love caucuses. And then you have the problems with some very weird delegate counts where, you know, it's calculated by congressional district or it's calculated by state senate district, and you get these weird anomalies where, for example, in Nevada, Hillary Clinton won, I think, 51% to 45, but she ended up with fewer delegates. And likewise in Texas, because of the dual system of having a primary and a caucus, Barack Obama fell modestly behind in the popular vote. I think it was a 3-point deficit.
Well, Andrew Gumbel,
he too ended up with more delegates.
It sounds like we're back where we always are in this conversation, is that we still have to wait to see as they thrash it out on the way to Denver in August and passing through Pennsylvania on the way. Andrew Gumbel, Los Angeles correspondent for The Independent of London, thanks so much for weighing in with us.
It's a pleasure.
And we'll be back to talk about green-collar jobs, both candidates proposing them, here and now. The Labor Department said today that new applications for unemployment benefits shot up to the highest level in more than 2 years, 407,000 new claims just last week. For decades, blue and white-collar jobs have formed the bulk of the workforce. Well, now green-collar is the hot hue, and some analysts hope it will make a dent in the unemployment numbers. Earlier this week, you might remember, we spoke with Van Jones of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights in Oakland, California. He said he's trying to bring green jobs to America's black neighborhoods. Well, that got us wondering, what exactly is a green job, and how many green-collar workers can the economy produce and sustain? Our next guest says a quarter of Americans could be green-collar in 25 years. Dr. Roger Bezdek is an energy and management consultant who studied the matter for the American Solar Energy Society. Dr. Bezdek, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you found that in 2006, sales from renewable energy and energy efficiency outpaced the total sales for Walmart, ExxonMobil, and General Motors in the same year. That would seem astonishing.
Yes, and it's by a large margin also. We put that in the report to emphasize that these industries, technologies, and green jobs, if you wish, are here today and now. It's not a pie in the sky, 20, 25 years or 30 years out into the future type of event. These industries are producing substantial sales, revenues, profits, and jobs at the present time.
Well, given that it's become very trendy for companies to greenwash, to sort of, put a product out front that might be somewhat sustainable, but the company really isn't, or have an advertising campaign that sounds as if it's good for the environment or sustainable or energy efficient when it's really not. Given that, what exactly is a green job?
Well, as a green job, as we define it in this report, is one that is linked directly or indirectly to either the renewable energy industry or the energy efficient industry or industries. Fairly simple, however, in specifically defining what is a renewable energy industry or technology or product, is very difficult and very complex undertaking.
Well, in fact, you even say in the report that it can get tricky. We understand that the word green job, the phrase, has been around since 1992. It was used to refer to very clearly green jobs, people in environmental work. Now, as you write in your report, let's say someone works for a company that makes solar panels. That's a green job. But what about the person who works for the subcontractor that may produce carbon-emitting energy needed to make a part of that panel? Is that still a green job?
In our definition, it is. We'll take it one step further, if you wish. What about environmental compliance officers who work in coal-fired power plants, or people who work in industries that produce scrubbers for power plants? It is not an easy or generally, maybe not even a generally agreed upon definition, but you have to set your standards somewhere.
You studied green jobs in the state of Ohio, which paid for part of the study. Why Ohio?
We liked using Ohio as a case study because it's a Midwest, a heavily industrialized state that has had a lot of problems with loss of industrial jobs, deindustrialization over the past decade or so.
Right. And what was your conclusion?
What we found is that Ohio is generally behind the curve in most of these renewable energy areas. They're simply not getting a major share of the industries, technologies, or jobs, and there's a danger that they're likely to fall further behind before they catch up.
Well, and that sort of becomes a microcosm for your overall thought about the U.S., which is that if the U.S. doesn't start generating these green-collar jobs, other countries will, and the whole country will be behind.
That is correct. It's ironic. Many of the types of new technology, new alternative energy, renewable energy technologies that we're dealing with these days, such as photovoltaics and wind, the U.S. Invented these and was certainly in the lead in the 70s and the early 80s, and then the bottom dropped out for support for these technologies. And the intervening decades, countries like Germany and Japan and other countries in Europe and Asia have become the leaders, and now we're trying to play catch-up. But we emphasize that it's really the government can certainly assist, but it's really up to private industry and the market to make this happen.
Right. And as you all know, a lot of people worry about job loss. You know, if green industry is taking over, then what happens to coal workers and other workers? And you had some figures that showed that actually there isn't a lot of job loss if the nation starts converting to green and sustainable jobs.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much a net gain. Jobs in the coal industry and the oil industry and natural gas industry are not going to go away. In fact, they will probably increase as well as the U.S. and the world requires more and more energy in the future. But the idea is to at least gradually focus on or shift into these areas that create the green jobs, so they gradually become not only larger in absolute numbers, but also a greater portion of the U.S. employment and labor force.
Well, what do you say to people like Columbia University economist Marcellus Andrews, who says, you know, well, people were talking about green-collar jobs as a solution to low-skilled unemployment, overestimate the number of jobs, underestimate the supply of labor. What do you think about the criticism that this really is pie in the sky, and also the fear that green jobs are somehow vastly different from jobs?
No, that's absolutely wrong, and that's a point I make in everything I publish and every speech I give, that the overwhelming majority of the jobs we're talking about are exactly the same types of jobs that exist today, mm-hmm. 85, 90, 95% of them. For example, when we looked at the occupational profile of manufacturing jobs in a plant that produces, you know, large-scale wind energy systems, almost all of the jobs are for machinists, assemblers, engineers, processors, clerks. The overwhelming majority of the jobs will not be for PhDs in renewable energy or ecology or something. They'll be for skilled, semi-skilled, highly skilled, and many unskilled types of labor.
What do you say to people who say there's just not enough money and taxpayer money to do this?
There's no doubt over the next several decades that it'll require a lot of money from both the private and the public sectors. If you want to make major changes, especially in the infrastructure and the economy, it takes money. But this is nothing all that unique. About 10 or 12 years ago, the state of South Carolina gave BMW something like $500 million in tax incentives to locate a manufacturing plant in the state that produced several thousand jobs. States are doing this all the time. They're desperate trying to get new industries, new technologies, and new jobs. I mean, look what the states and cities spend on sports stadiums.
As we have seen, America and American business reacts to what works on Wall Street. So do you see a time when, you know, people aren't doing green-collar jobs because it's the right thing to do and it reduces emissions and it's better for America's future, but because it's, you know, the financially successful and smart thing to do?
Absolutely. And we're hopefully transitioning to that point very quickly. And the only way that renewable energy or green technology or energy efficiency is going to succeed is when people are doing it for reasons of profit. That's what drives private industry. That's what drives the economy. And we're moving in that direction, and hopefully that will be the major, if not the sole, consideration for investment or product development, what have you.
Dr. Roger Bezdek, founder and president of Management Information Services, a Washington, D.C.-based economic and energy research firm. Dr. Bezdek, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And a quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, Garbage Man, the green job that deserves more respect. An anthropologist has been riding the trucks in Manhattan to get that word out. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, we can't call it March Madness anymore because it's April, but it's mad, I tell you. It's down to the Final Four for the men and women in pursuit of college basketball's national title. Here to talk about that and the rest of the week in sports, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, I am so out of the, what do you call it, the grid here at work.
Well, most people call them brackets, but that's all right. Grid will work for you, I suppose.
Well, earlier you said, oh, your brackets have fallen. I said, that is personal, young man. But yeah, I'm just done. And so let's take a look
at what
remains.
Here and now after dark? What are we doing here?
On Saturday, to the men, Memphis plays UCLA. North Carolina takes on Kansas. The winners face off for the title on Monday. All of the team's top seeds. How did I miss this? No Cinderellas this year. So does that make it less exciting, do you think?
No, it doesn't make it less exciting. As you say, there are no long shots, although Memphis coach John Calipari will continue to present his team as a long shot because I don't know why, but he does that.
For their heads, maybe.
Yeah, maybe for their heads. No, it's all good teams. It'll be fun. There'll be some good games. I think everybody's looking forward to the finals.
And, of course, the women on Sunday. Tuesday night, Connecticut came from behind to beat Rutgers. You know, we love Coach Vivian Stringer, so it's tough to see her go. They will face Stanford, Connecticut. LSU takes on defending champion Tennessee. And many fans are hoping for a Tennessee-UConn rematch. Are you one of those?
Well, I am one of them in the sense that UConn and Tennessee don't play each other in the regular season anymore because their coaches are feuding, and so it'll be
nice to see them.
Well, yeah, they simply refuse to schedule each other. Pat Summitt down at Tennessee said the heck with it. I don't like him, and I don't want to play his team.
Who's him?
Him would be the coach up in Connecticut.
They can just do this?
Well, she did it, and nobody's quite sure why it's happening, but we hope they will play in the finals. My hope, of course, is that Tennessee is healthy. Candace Parker, who's their most important, most effective player, played the last part of their last game with her shoulder held in place by duct tape, so I hope she's okay. The article I read earlier today said she'd be all right.
Okay, professional basketball, playoff time approaching. Five of the top contenders for the NBA championship are in the Western Conference, as my nephew keeps reminding me. He says the teams are better there. The two teams with the best chances in the East, the Boston Celtics and the Detroit Pistons. Now, some of the odds makers are seeing another classic Celtics-LA Lakers showdown, which would be tough for my household. What do you see here?
Oh, well, it's kind of a funny idea. You know, Kevin Garnett is Larry Bird, Kobe Bryant is Magic Johnson. Might be kind of fun, but it's a bit early, probably, to predict that that will be the final. A couple of good teams in the West, and Detroit is a strong team. They may give the Celtics quite a fight.
Meanwhile, in New York, Isaiah Thomas out as Knicks president. In is former Indiana Pacer president Donnie Walsh. Thomas stays on as coach for now. You know, all the controversy, despite all the controversy. Walsh gave Thomas his first coaching job in Indiana in 2000. But after the season the Knicks have had under Thomas, you know, as we said, both on and off the court, won't Walsh be under a lot of pressure to let Thomas go?
Well, the short answer to that question is yes. And I'm not going to say anything else original about it, except that last week Charlie Pierce referred to Isaiah Thomas as Coach Stupid, and we got a note, an email from a listener who wants to marry Charlie as a result of that comment. So the depth of feeling against Isaiah Thomas is considerable.
We should say he was accused of harassment by an employee and went through a trial, a very public trial. So there's much
plus
controversy there.
His basketball team rarely wins. These are bad. That's a bad combination of things.
There you are. Major League Baseball. New York Mets ace Pedro Martinez will miss the next 4 to 6 weeks after pulling a hamstring. He made this pitch and you saw him pull right up. That was in his first game. Joe Torre wins his first game as manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers. But, you know, some listeners object when we do this. We are based here in Boston, but we can't help it. You say the sweetest story of the week came from Red Sox pitcher Daisuke Matsuzaka.
Well, it was nice. I mean, after he won the game in Oakland, and only after he won the game in Oakland, he said to the press, "I just wish that I'd pitched better when I pitched in the Tokyo Dome in front of the Japanese fans." He didn't say anything about it while he was there, but he really wished that he'd been more on his game that particular day.
Yeah, he didn't do quite well at all. I attribute that to jet lag. Bill Littlefield, host of National Public Radio's weekly sports program Only a Game. Bill, thank you so much. And by the way, I don't think we mentioned the coach of the UConn
Gino
team.
Auriemma, and right. I just tripped over my tongue, and I apologize for that, Robin. But thank you very much. It's been a pleasure as always.
And don't sit Gino and Pat next to each other at dinner. Don't forget to listen to Bill's program on the weekends. Coming up, Martin Scorsese and the Rolling Stones. The new film will have a review here and now. When Mick Jagger wanted to make a concert film of the Rolling Stones' A Bigger Bang Tour of 2005-2006, he turned to filmmaker Martin Scorsese. But Scorsese didn't want to just film the band's million-person concert on the beach in Rio de Janeiro or any of their big stadium shows. He wanted a more intimate feel, so Scorsese persuaded the Stones to do smaller shows at the Beacon Theater in New York in the fall of 2006. The result is Shine a Light, mostly concert, part documentary footage, and clips of old Stones interviews. It opens in theaters tomorrow, and joining us in the studio with her take, here and now, pop culture critic Renee Graham. Renee, what did you think? You're a big Stones fan.
I'm a big Stones fan, so of course I like the film. You know, whether it will appeal to people who aren't huge Stones fans is another question entirely.
This was a project that we said that Mick Jagger started, obviously something the band wanted to do, but why now?
I think perhaps, who knows, that could have been the Stones' last tour. None of them are getting any younger. Guitarist Ron Wood is the youngest at 60. Charlie Watts is 66. And both Jagger and Richards are 64 years old. So maybe this is the last tour, and maybe they wanted to get a chance to get that on film. Then again, you know, I wouldn't bet against them.
Well, and it's Martin Scorsese. And, you know, and this isn't the first time you remind us that Rolling Stones' music and Martin Scorsese's films have connected.
He's obviously a big fan of this band. He's used the Stones music in his films ranging from Mean Streets to Goodfellas to The Departed. Some of the dangerous energy, the mood, all those sort of rhythms incorporating rock and blues and country just have always really served his films really, really well.
Vin, don't make me have to come down here again for this.
Won't happen again, Mr. C.
Carmen's developing into a fine young lady. You should be proud.
A scene from The Departed with Jack Nicholson, of course, as Frank Costello. Renee, Martin Scorsese's done a concert documentary before.
One of the best musical documentaries ever, 1978's The Last Waltz, which chronicled the final performance of the band, right. Who were originally Bob Dylan's backing band and just wonderful artists in their own right, and this big show they did in San Francisco in 1976.
So, as you say, The Last Waltz, one of the best music films ever. Let's grade the current one, the Rolling Stones. Start with, you know, setting it up. How does it start?
We get little performance clips throughout their tour, but mainly what we get is scenes of Martin Scorsese and his crew trying to set this all up. In the scene we're going to hear, it's Martin Scorsese and Mick Jagger talking on the phone about how to actually execute what they want to do in New York at the show.
My other worry about the cameras was, Marty, that they whiz around all the time, and that's very annoying to the audience and to everyone on the stage, and it's dangerous.
It'd be good to have a camera that moves, that swoops down and in and out,
yeah,
and tracks us, you know, along the side somehow.
It feels a little like when Lorne Michaels used to inject himself into a skit on Saturday Night Live.
It does feel a little bit like that. At the beginning, you start to wonder if this isn't going to be a film about Martin Scorsese making a film about the Rolling Stones. I'm not sure those scenes actually work. They just feel very staged, and it's just stuff that I don't think people want to know. If you go to see a concert from the Rolling Stones, you want to see the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
He talked the Rolling Stones into performing at the Beacon Theater in New York, a lovely theater, holds fewer than 3,000 people. He wanted this much more intimate feel. Well, the Stones generally do not play 3,000-seat theaters. They play arenas. They play, you know, Fenway Park, they've played the Meadowlands in New Jersey. They play really big venues.
You had some other thoughts about the look of the film. There's a front row crowd in particular that you felt was just like, who are these?
Just these really pretty, tanned, lovely young people looking like extras from MTV's The Hills. I kept looking at them thinking, what are they doing at this show? Not to say that the Rolling Stones fans can't be young and pretty, but I just thought they were there because they were going to look good in the film.
Somehow placed there.
Yes.
Well, but what about the music? Musical highlights.
The music is the music. I mean, the music holds up. You know, does this replace seeing them live? Absolutely not. You need to see the Stones live if you haven't done so already. But what's remarkable is for a band that's been doing this for 40 years, they're surprisingly unjaded. The Stones are putting blood, sweat, and tears out there, and that's saying a lot. You know, they don't have to work this hard, but they absolutely do, and that does come across in the film.
Stuck around St. Petersburg when I saw it was the time
for a change.
We also understand the Stones had guests at the Beacon Theatre shows, Jack White of the White Stripes, for instance, but one guest in particular you want to talk about.
Buddy Guy comes out and he does a version of Muddy Waters' Champagne and Reefer with the Rolling Stones. It is, for me, the musical highlight of that concert.
Let's listen.
Give me champagne when I'm thirsty. Give me a reefer when I want to get high. Give me a woman when I get lonely. And settle right down here by my side. Well, your time. No, there shouldn't be no law. But a man wanna smoke a little dope. Hey, Mick. No, there shouldn't be no law. But a man wanna smoke a little dope.
When you look at Buddy Guy there and you see the Rolling Stones, you understand that that's who the Rolling Stones compare themselves to. They see themselves as these classic bluesmen. They've loved their whole lives. The Buddy Guys, the Howlin' Wolves, the Muddy Waters, guys who performed to their 60s, 70s, and 80s. And no one looked at them and said, why are they still doing this? That's why it made perfectly good sense for them to have Buddy Guy there. They're always paying tribute to the people who inspire them. A lot of people who inspire them are these wonderful, classic American bluesmen.
Although Buddy Guy was probably also saying, who are those people in the front row?
Exactly.
Well, we also know that Scorsese's film uses old interviews with the band. We have one with Mick Jagger. Let's just listen to a little of that.
How much longer did you feel yourself doing this thing, going around being a sort of...
I don't know. I never thought I'd be doing it for 2 years even, you know.
What do those clips do?
They're interesting to see because, of course, the Rolling Stones look rather decrepit these days. But in these clips, they're so young. They're really handsome. They all look like they just stepped out of grade school. But what the clips constantly do, and there's a real purpose in the clips that he selects, they always sort of deal with the fact that either the Stones didn't think they'd last this long or the fact that they knew they'd go on forever. So you have a clip of Mick Jagger saying, you know, I think we can last another year. You know, which he probably said in 1965, and of course we know they've continued to go on. And then there's a clip later in the film where he talks about, where he's asked, can you see yourself doing this at 60? And he says, yes. Mm. You know, so it's always this kind of idea that, oh my God, look, they're still out there, still, you know, playing rock and roll and playing it hard.
Well, you covered the Rolling Stones for the Boston Globe when they played Fenway Park. You know, as you've said, you know, this film is great, but maybe that was more authentic?
I think that would have been the show. If you're going to make a concert film about that tour, then you should have made about that show, because you had, first of all, you know, the remarkable setting of Fenway Park, and you got the real essence of what that tour was, with this huge moving stage, this incredible audience, just so diverse in terms of race, gender, age, you name it. That you don't really get. You don't really see a lot of the audience except for those really, really, really pretty shiny people in the front. I don't think you make it more intimate by somehow squeezing them into a theater and making it into this thing which I think serves the film better than it might actually serve those who haven't seen the Stones in concert.
Yeah, but for some of us, you can't always get what you want. And sometimes...
you get what you need.
And it might just be this documentary. It's a new Rolling Stones concert documentary, Shine a Light, directed by Martin Scorsese, opens in theaters tomorrow. Here and out, pop culture critic Renee Graham. What should we play out?
Brown Sugar.
All right. Mama, what a potential queen. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now. Brown sugar, just like a